6:05, happy Wednesday. I got to tell, let me roll back the curtain a little bit for you.
Guess what day
it is?
Yes. Hump day.
Hump day here on a Wednesday morning on JR Morning. Around this time of year, things start to get a little slow, news-wise. And we do our best to bring you stuff that you need to know about that might not be the biggest news stories of the day, but that's what every newsroom, it's what every news organization goes through around this time of year. Every time we approach July 4th, things start to just power down. But not this year. not this week. Because obviously we've got the 250th celebration of our country coming in just a couple of days. If that wasn't enough, we are getting all kinds of information from the Supreme Court, decisions like this on birthright citizenship. The U.S. Supreme Court, there was a lot of back and forth about this. And in this ruling, the Supreme Court ruled that birthright citizenship basically goes on as it has been. That birthright citizenship, as it stands today, will continue. And it was a divided Supreme Court when it came, and I mean, this is a close decision, but a 6-3 vote struck down the president's order. Chief Justice John Roberts upheld that the long-settled understanding of the 14th Amendment adopted after the Civil War makes a citizen of anyone born in the country with very limited expectations. The Chief Justice wrote, "Citizenship then and now was the right to have rights, to freely participate in our political community. The framers of the 14th Amendment extended that promise to every freeborn person in this land. We keep that promise today." Justices Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Clarence Thomas voted on the other way. And in fact, in his dissent, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote, "The court today takes the extraordinary step of holding unconstitutionally the president's order excluding from citizenship the children of foreign temporary visitors and illegal aliens. In doing so, the court adds to the sad history of the 14th Amendment, which was designed and understood to secure equal rights for the freed blacks, but has instead been repurposed for political projects that the Reconstruction Congress did not support." And again, this goes back to, it goes back to your interpretation of the law. And I always hate the argument of, well, this is a heavily slanted conservative court. Well, they just voted opposite the president. And by the way, it isn't the first time. But there was precedent in this case. And it was the United States versus Wong Kim Ark. And the question that was presented there was whether a child born in the United States of parents of Chinese descent who at the time were subjects of the Emperor of China but remained in a permanent residence in the United States, was their child considered a member, a person of this country? And the answer then was yes. And that precedent certainly seemed to carry over in the case of birthright citizenship. Also yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled on transgender athletes. They ruled 6-3 that states may restrict girls and women's sports teams to athletes based on biological sex, upholding laws in West Virginia and Idaho that were challenged by transgender athletes. Those cases centered in West Virginia and Idaho, centered on whether transgender girls and women have the right under Title IX and the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause to compete on teams matching their gender identity. And so now that gets upheld as well. What is interesting about that particular decision, and one of the questions that was being posed to the court, was, does this violate Title IX? And this was a protection for women, a civil rights bill that was signed into law to protect women. And all nine justices agreed that these bans do not violate Title IX protections. But they obviously were split on the constitutionality of it all. And we'll talk to Reggie Passis of Butts Along coming up next. He's an immigration attorney there, so we'll get his perspective coming up at 6:19 and what that means. Meanwhile, the Michigan budget has not yet been passed. Lawmakers, and by the way, this July 1st deadline, this is a self-imposed July 1st deadline. The new fiscal year doesn't start till October. So these ongoing negotiations between Governor Gretchen Whitmer and the Senate, which is controlled by Democrats, and the House, which is controlled by Republicans, they say they have a budget framework in place. But there's a lot of major details, I think, that haven't been resolved yet, including spending levels at a bunch of different levels. You've got school funding that's still in question, different policy priorities that are still in question. Matt Hall is certainly looking for a smaller budget. He's not looking for tax increases. And he's not looking to use the state's rainy day fund. But the governor and Senate Democrats have a different perspective. They want a larger spending plan. And so we will talk about that today as well with our with one of the members of the state legislature. Mike Harris will join us to talk about that coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Meanwhile, the president has renewed his push for the Save America Act after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that states can continue counting mail ballots after Election Day as long as they were cast at the proper time during Election Day. It was a 5-4 decision that upheld those election rules. And the president said that was a tremendous loss. He said that it wasn't good for our country. He's going to respect it because it's the Supreme Court. But now the attention turns to Congress. Several Republican senators are looking at the Save America Act that requires photo identification, proof of citizenship for voting, and tighter restrictions on mail-in voting again. But now what the Supreme Court has done essentially in that case is they've kicked that down to lawmakers. They say, this isn't our issue, this is your issue. And certainly the Save America Act is a part of that. Tigers win over the Yankees last night, 9-3. Five home runs. Tarek Skubal, dominant. He said he felt good.
You know, I think the last time was pretty good, too. This time was obviously, I think the results were a little bit better. But I think, I think it's right on par with kind of how I've been feeling. You know, even the second one, you know, against the White Sox, I thought was a good one. The first one against Cleveland definitely felt a little bit, you know, I was kind of a little bit maybe more amped up or something because I was spraying the ball a little bit, just excited to be back out there. And I think that's just the human element of the game. But, you know, I felt great. You know, I don't think the results have kind of been a testament of who I am and the stuff coming out of my hand.
Well, we were talking a little bit about Riley Green yesterday, Jace.
Yes.
He came through. Riley Green, a couple of home runs, three RBI, Kerry Carpenter, Spencer Torkelson, and James Outman all going.
Against arguably the best pitcher in the American League, starting pitcher so far.
How about that?
One of my favorite stat when Skubal pitches a game like this, my absolute favorite stat, no walks.
And he just pounds the strike zone.
Love it.
It's what he does best. Coming up on the other side, Reggie Passis at Butts Along joins us to talk about the Supreme Court ruling on birthright citizenship. It's next on JR Morning. So the Supreme Court upheld birthright citizenship. And it was certainly a groundbreaking decision. You remember the president was at that hearing when they heard those oral arguments initially. And now birthright citizenship stays as is at the moment. So let's talk about it. Reggie Passis is an attorney focusing exclusively on immigration law and joins us from Butzel. Reggie, good morning. It's good to have you back.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So the Supreme Court focused on the nationwide injunctions, not the merits of birthright citizenship itself, right? So what impact does this actually have on these families now today?
Right. Well, so not bad for a nice slow day, right?
Yeah, that's it. That's right. Exactly right.
So, yeah, what impact right now? Well, basically, life goes on. The children that are born from here on out are still considered United States citizens by birth. So in terms of the practical effect of everyday life in the American society and for the 250th anniversary of the founding of our country, we just go on. But I know the vote was 6-3. However, the vote was really closer in a decision like this than most people think. The reason why I say that, I know you made some comments earlier about the case, but from what I could see, is that the vote in terms of the ultimate result was 6-3, but in rationale on how the court got there was really 5-4. Mm. And it was Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence that actually pointed out that he felt that the majority of the Supreme Court did not have to go through the constitutional analysis, just really relied on federal statutes. So, you know, change a Supreme Court justice opinion here or there, make a, you know, change the legislation on birthright citizenship. And, you know, this could go the other, this could either go farther into further protection for birthright citizenship, or it could go the other way in terms of birthright citizenship. So this was a lot closer decision than most people are willing to give credit to.
Well, and one of Clarence Thomas's remarks in the dissent was basically, that's not what the 14th Amendment was framed for. The 14th Amendment was designed for freed slaves to become citizens of the United States of America. And now using it in a completely different way for people that don't have, you know, a strong moral fabric woven into the United States, that there's some, it's not quite as, there's not as much quite as continuity there as maybe some would say there is.
Right. And that is what Justice Thomas wrote about. But what Justice Roberts and the majority wrote about was the historical underpinnings of the 14th Amendment. And the majority took the view of, look, where's the word domicile in the 14th Amendment? Where's the word allegiance in the 14th Amendment? It's not there. The court was trying to construct it based upon the second part of the 14th Amendment, where it says, you know, subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
Right.
You know, language. Now, the way the majority read that, based upon the history of the debate of the 14th Amendment, the formation of it, was yes, the ultimate goal at the time was to grant citizenship to the you know, post-Civil War environment with you know, the freeing of slaves and things, but the issue there is they were also concerned about children of diplomats, right? Mm-hmm. Children of diplomats can exercise diplomatic immunity and are not therefore subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. So the 14th Amendment was designed to exclude children who were born to diplomats, but not anybody else. I mean, if they wanted to put an allegiance test or put in a domicile test, those words would have been in there.
I want to play a little bit of audio. This is from Vice President J.D. Vance on what's next for birthright citizenship.
Fundamentally, what we're talking about is fixing a problem the Supreme Court created. We also want to look over the long term at undoing that problem to begin with, because, again, this was only a 5-4 decision.
So where do we go from here?
Well, so the Supreme Court was designed to interpret the Constitution of the United States. It's the third branch of government. All right. And that's what they did here. The executive, or the president, and everybody else under it, which includes the vice president, is charged with enforcing the rules. All right. There are still a number of tools that the government has in terms of enforcement of law. I mean, you know, every day when people come in, I mean, the whole concern that they're having is about this birther tourism issue. Every day when people come to the United States, what do you do when you get off the plane? The first person you meet that's outside the people you're traveling with and any passenger is a U.S. Customs and Border Protection officer. Mm-hmm. All right. So there are tools there that they can use to try and where they interview people and try and determine a person's intent to come in the United States. All right. People can examine why you're coming in. If a person's got a health issue in terms of, you know, being 8 or 9 months pregnant, you know, that can be questioned, that can be interviewed. There are a number of tools that can go out that way as well, all right? And then there, you know, the as we read in the news also, they're in charge with enforcing the immigration laws in the United States, all right? They could also pass legislation that can regulate, childbirth in terms of whether they want to include insurance for that or not in that, all that stuff. So there are still a number of tools that the executive branch can employ, and those are just the ones that I'm thinking of off the top of my head. I'm sure there are other ones, but, you know, I think we talked about this when the order was first put out there back in January 2025, and I said, you don't take away, just because you have a few speeders, you don't take away everyone's cars.
Sure.
Well, it's the same thing here. Just because we have a few outliers that and it is a minority of people who are abusing our rule in terms of birthright citizenship, you don't take away everybody's ability to become a citizen just because they are born here. So that would be my response to the vice president.
Yeah, it's fascinating and certainly a hot button issue. And the Supreme Court made their decision. You're right; seemed to be a lot closer than what that vote actually was. Reggie Passas, thanks so much. Always good to catch up with you. Thank you for your time, and we'll talk again very soon.
No problem. Thank you, Chris. In regards to Jamie and her family, and hope she's doing well.
Thank you. Yes, we appreciate that. She is doing well, and hopefully she hops on with us tomorrow, I think is the plan, as long as she's feeling well enough. So hopefully we'll talk to her tomorrow. Thank you. We appreciate that. Meanwhile, coming up on the other side, we're going to talk, as we get ready for the 250, you know, everybody's got a story, and there's so many wonderful connections here in the state of Michigan to what we have contributed, and the folks that have rich family histories, families that either moved west as expansion was exploding. And we're going to hear from somebody who had relatives who fought in the American Revolution, and we're going to hear from her next here on JR Morning. You're not going to want to miss it. Well, about 100 and almost 30 years, more than 120 years after the end of the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence gets signed, an organization was created in the late 1800s, and it was called DAR, Daughters of the American Revolution, and it highlights the connection, the rich history, the connection that people have had to those that fought for our freedom, that fought for the liberation of the control of the British Empire. And after the initial chapter was created and housed in Washington, D.C., that same organization expanded. And they, of course, came to Michigan. And now there are many DAR chapters here in the state of Michigan and many subgroups. And as a result, we are hearing stories from people who have family members that date all the way back to the 1700s, the 1770s, when patriots were fighting for the liberation of what became the United States of America. And Judy Van Popperen is the state co-chair of America 250, the committee, and with Michigan DAR, the Daughters of the American Revolution. Judy, good morning. It's good to have you this morning.
Why, thank you. Good morning. And I would like to correct you. We are not DAR. We are D-A-R.
D-A-R.
Yeah, USA for United States of America.
I love it. D-A-R, the Daughters of the American Revolution. Tell us a little bit about your connection.
Well, it started with my aunt. She was challenged by somebody who said, you can't qualify for this. So she did research and found out that I did have a patriot that was in the Revolutionary War. And so I joined the D-A-R under her original application. His name was Nathaniel Nichols, and he, as I understand it, I have to do the research to confirm this, was somewhat of a scoundrel, and he had a choice to serve in the military or go to prison because he performed some sort of petty crime at the time, and he chose the military. He was out of Connecticut, one of the states that I haven't been to yet, but that is how I was able to qualify for the DAR.
And so in doing some of this preliminary research, what was that like for you?
It was like going down rabbit holes. You go online and you find one little nugget, and then you have to investigate that nugget to find out whether or not it's true. And since then, I have approximately 13 patriots that I descend from. That is what I've been able to confirm. And in order to know that you descend from a patriot, you have to follow the documentation. So that's going into a lot of vital records from different states, different counties, different towns, sometimes even church records and wills to find the connection of you to these other people.
That sounds like a full-time job.
Yeah, it is for some people.
It's a fascinating story. So when you go down these rabbit holes, what do what have you discovered amongst these 13 folks?
Well, I found that on my father's side, Nathaniel Nichols was on my mother's side. On my father's side, he descends from a gentleman called Ebenezer Dorr. He was born in 1712. His son, who I descend from, was a loyalist. He was given property from King George III for his service during the French and Indian War. But his brother, Ebenezer Dorr, was a patriot. And he was one of the unnamed people that rode the same night as Paul Revere. Because if you remember Longfellow's poem, Ebenezer Dorr doesn't sound near as good as Paul Revere.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah. That's fair. And so when you do this research and you find that you have these connections, what are the what was the first feeling when you found out about Nathaniel Nichols, for example? It sounds like that was the first name that you came across that had the connection.
Yeah.
What was your reaction?
It's a sense of pride. You only think that you are as old, your history is as old as your maybe great grandparents, if you had you were fortunate enough to know them. But then to go back and say, oh, geez, those people traveled from Massachusetts and ended up in the Manchester area in Michigan. What was that travel like in 1820s, 1830s? How did they get all that way with a horse, buggy? How many people walked? You know, it's like we take for granted what it is that we have today, that we can just go to the store and pick something up. They weren't that lucky to be able to pick up a loaf of bread. They had to bring it along with them.
Yeah. And so what is DAR doing for the 250?
The DAR in Michigan has been active for several years. We started with a first Patriot marker for the Revolutionary War as part of America 250 in 2022. That marker was placed in Lansing between the State Capitol building and the Hall of Justice. There is a veterans park there. We also placed one in Kalamazoo at the Rose Park Veterans Park, another one in Traverse City. We've placed them in Rochester, as well as the oldest town in Michigan, Sault Ste. Marie. We placed one up in the Chippewa County Courthouse. But also there's been many markers signifying America 250 and the Patriots' sacrifice throughout the state, by a lot of local chapters too.
It's very cool. The other thing that I have to imagine would be really interesting is when all you guys get together and you start sharing these stories, like everybody has some connection. Everybody's got an individual story. Do you ever find any crossover?
Yes. Just this past week, we had our national convention, and there's a webpage called Family Search. And in Family Search, one of the drop-down boxes is Find Relatives Near Me. So you can push that button, and it scans if anybody else has their Family Search app up and running. I found a lady that I was sitting next to descended from William Bradford, who was the first governor for Plymouth in Massachusetts. That I was related to her, like the first cousin nine times removed, and another lady just in front of us. And these were things that we didn't know we had that connection with. So it's interesting to find who you're related to when you didn't even know them other than brushing against them in a meeting.
Yeah, really fascinating stuff. And it's so wonderful that you've done the due diligence to go down that path and find those connections. And what a wonderful story. Judy Van Popper, thank you so much. We appreciate your time. And we can't wait for the 4th in just a few days.
Okay, thank you very much for your time and talking with me.
Yeah, you got it. Coming up on the other side, the challenge of freight carriers and how it's affecting the automotive industry. We'll talk about that next here on JR Morning. You know, no pun intended, but the automotive industry has to be run like a fine-tuned machine. And it's a domino effect. If one part of the chain is a little weaker, or if it isn't up to snuff, well, all of a sudden, car production slows, vehicle prices get higher, there's shortages, there's delays. And part of that process is about transportation. Now, whether that's moving parts to different factories, whether that's moving finished cars to dealerships, the realities are our transportation needs are incredibly vital to the success of the automotive industry. And when it comes to freight carriers, we've heard the problems on that front. The shortages have made these transportation of these products incredibly difficult in some instances. So what are we doing about it? Let's talk about it with Gary Horton, the co-founder and CEO of ACI Transport. Gary, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about what this means, what this means for the industry, because we've talked about the small fleet carriers that there seem to be less and less of them these days. And there's regulatory changes that are afoot as well. How much pressure does that put on the transportation side of the industry?
That's a great question. It puts a fair amount of pressure on it, especially for support businesses like ACI Transport, where we're a third-party logistics company. So a lot of what we're doing is taking over the responsibility of transport from our clients. So we work with carriers of all walks, sizes, every day at ACI Transport. So the small independent carriers are getting a lot of pressure from both increased material costs, costs of doing business, as well as regulation and deregulation as well. So it puts a lot of pressure on the partnerships. However, as you have clientele that expands their needs, you can go and seek out carriers that are doing great business, and many of them are still independent and thriving, even with the challenges of today.
You talked a little bit about the regulation side of it. I wanted to ask you about how these policy changes impact the business.
Yeah, absolutely. So they've actually done a really important push on regulating drivers and carrier companies to have a little bit more sophistication in the record keeping, safety ratings, as well as licensing of drivers. This is great. It helps to increase safety whenever we get visibility of how drivers and carriers are running their business. However, it does create additional hoops to jump through, which can increase final costs to the consumer, as well as ancillary costs for things like repair, gas, and other activities like that.
Mm. And the communication, I have to imagine, is pretty important between the deliverer and the person who ends up with these products, because there's so many pieces at play here, right? They're waiting for your product that you're bringing Absolutely. Over to them in order to finish the job.
Yeah, you know, ACI Transport, the C stands for communication. Honestly, I think it's the number one thing that we can provide and facilitate in the movement of material, vehicles, etc. What happens is, as a consumer, transport is often a secondary part of your business. It's something that supports your primary value proposition. And so any time you're spending on that is time that you're not spending on your business. So when you need to be able to move items in support of your business, product to your customers, et cetera, you want to be able to do that while not having to watch it every second of the day. And you want to have clean, proactive communication when things are happening on the ground, issues, problems, that you don't have the visibility of. So yeah, communication is one absolutely vital, and I think the number one most important factor to successful transport.
Gary Horton with ACI Transport, thanks so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. Interesting look inside the industry.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You have a great morning.
Yeah, you do the same. I got to tell you this story. So you know I'm moving, and we've got movers coming this week, and we are not prepared for them. But I get a call, and by the way, we are closing on our house in just a few days. Closing on our house in just a few days. Hottest days of the year are here. I get a call after the show yesterday from my wife. She goes, "Guess what?" And I said, "What, honey?" I didn't say that. I said, what? She goes, our air conditioner isn't working. Oh, perfect. If there was a perfect time to not have your air working, it's right now. We have to pack up the house. We got to get the kids somewhere where they're not distracting us. I need to have complete focus on getting this house ready for these movers to come this week. And the air goes out. I walk into the house yesterday after I get home from the show. It was like noon, 11:30. And the house was 90 degrees. It was a hot box. I'm like, what are we going to do? So thankfully, we've got somebody coming out today, and I got a CNC heating and air is coming to the house. Our one of our sales executives, Mike Pierce, Jim Corian, the head over there at CNC, is coming out today. What a godsend. And by the way, I said, how many calls are you getting today? And he's like, oh, we'll have 500 calls of people's air not working or it's not cold enough or whatever. Everybody is dealing with this. But if there was a perfect time for your air not to work, it would be in these these couple of days because it is very, very hot. All right, taking a break. Get you caught up on the headlines. 7 o'clock hour coming up. Also, as we continue our focus on our founding fathers, James Madison steps into focus. It's coming up on JR Morning. I swear you can't make this up, people. So my air goes out yesterday. I'm in the middle of a move. Thank God for Jim Corian and the good folks at CNC Heating and Air Conditioning, great friends of the station. They're coming out today to take a look at it. My house is a sweltering hot box. And then as we're in the break, Brian gets this message.
Yeah, my wife texted me that there was some kind of loud pop, and now the power's out at my house. And I went to the DD power map, the outage map. Less than five people in your area are out of power.
Less than five. And you're one.
Yes. They say everything
you're the lucky one.
They say everything happens in threes. So hopefully.
Jason's turn.
Oh, Renee.
Renee or me. And Renee and I live very close to each other, so.
Jason's like, good luck, Renee.
I don't have anybody at home to let me know, so.
So it'll be a nice surprise when
I
you
hope,
get home.
Hopefully not.
No, I wouldn't wish that on you. But I think the overarching message here is that this happens to everybody. Everybody.
Yeah.
And by the way, the crazy part about my story is, like, we're at the finish line.
Yeah, I'm you're at almost the end. Out of the house.
And now I got to fix an air conditioner.
Right. You weren't going to be taking that with you.
No, the air conditioner was staying.
Right,
It's a
so
part of the house.
It said, Chris, we're going to miss you.
Although I will say, what's crazy? Here's crazy. Is when we bought this house almost a decade ago, it was only maybe 5 years old, not even, 3-4 years old. And the people who built the house didn't put an air conditioner in.
Wow.
And I'm like, how do you do that?
Right. Why?
How could you how? How could you possibly? How is that possible? It's not like you live in, you know, maybe you can make an argument in like Traverse City or somewhere further north, right? You just open the windows, it doesn't get quite as hot up there, but it gets hot in Traverse City.
Yes.
Like, I don't, that to me was, and then my wife, when we moved in, was pregnant, and she's like, yeah, air conditioning, you know.
I remember growing up, we didn't have central air until I was, I think, in like ninth grade. And I can't remember how we survived before that. It was probably just I was young.
You're young.
You don't
hot,
really
it
think
doesn't
about
matter.
It. But it's like, man, I couldn't even imagine nowadays.
No.
Surviving
no.
Well, without it.
No.
I understand if there's heavy wind. I understand if there's storm.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. That can knock down a line. That can just not a cloud in the sky.
It's like I said, Brian. Day. Something in that box is melting.
No, this is what in my family we call this the Morton fortune. If anything bad is going to happen, it comes to visit our house.
This is gonna be Brian later. He's gonna be at home. Well, no, you might not be watching TV. You're just going to be
saying this. We're going to get drunk before the game. We're going to get drunk during the game, and then we're going to get drunk after the game.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
There'll be a lot of
listening to it on the radio.
What we call, in front of the grandkids, engineering language.
Yeah, I look back. There's papers flying everywhere. Brian's hands are all up. This guy is out of his mind. I go, what's going on?
If you see Brian on the news, if I see Brian on the news later, I'll help produce the show for him.
Exactly. Meanwhile, speaking of getting drunk before, during, and after, the USA plays tonight, 8 o'clock, and they've got Bosnia and Herzegovina up on tap. And look, they lost their last game to Turkey, last second goal in the group stage. It doesn't matter. They're on to the round of 32. And we have seen some crazy, crazy games thus far. You know, Germany gets bounced, one of the favorites in this tournament. So anything can happen here. Anything can happen, good and bad. Like, the United States is not a heavy favorite, yet they've played really, really well, and they've beat some really good teams. So, you know, you just look at it and go, okay, well, hold on a second here. They got a little something brewing. Are they going to win the whole thing? Probably not. Hate to be a Debbie Downer going into the July 4th weekend. But regardless, they have a really, really good team, and I like their chances tonight. That's an 8 o'clock start time to that game on Fox, so that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm going to be dialed into that. I mean, dialed in. But I love this stuff. And I'll tell you what, you get into extra time, you get into penalty kicks, and the tension just ramps up and ramps up. Hopefully we don't get to that point. Hopefully we win 3-1, 3-0, something like that. But yeah, the tension really ramps up in the round of 32. You get to the 16. It's a win-or-go-home situation. Meanwhile, lots of consequential decisions by the Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court handed Donald Trump a procedural victory in the legal fight over his executive order restricting birthright citizenship, but the justices did not decide whether the order itself is constitutional. 6-3 ruling. The federal judges say that because of the 14th Amendment, things go on. There is no real change to birthright citizenship here. Obviously, the president wasn't happy with that decision, but John Roberts was joined by Justices Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and Amy Coney Barrett. They concluded that nearly anyone born on U.S. soil is a citizen regardless of whether their parents are in the country illegally or temporarily. Of course, that's relying on the text of the 14th Amendment. You've got Justice Clarence Thomas, who led the dissenters, Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch, that argued that citizenship requires a deeper connection to the United States other than simply being born here. The contention that the 14th Amendment was primarily to secure citizenship for formerly enslaved people here in the United States and not for people temporarily visiting the country. And that was not the interpretation of the Reconstruction era. That's according to the dissent. But again, the justices have said this has been the practice for a long time. There is nothing in the 14th Amendment that says that says otherwise. There's been precedent from the late 1800s in a case involving a Chinese family. And as a result, there's nothing in the Constitution that would lead them to believe otherwise. Although it was a closer decision than 6-4. That's how they ended up. Meanwhile, they also weighed in on the transgender athlete issue 6-3. The states may restrict girls and women's sports teams to athletes based on biological sex. That is according to a couple of laws that were being challenged out of West Virginia and Idaho. You know, the interesting part here is I went on like some of the more liberal social media sites, CNN, MS Now, whatever it is. And people in the comments section were like, I'm as progressive as they come, but this is the right decision. It seems like the tide has turned on this to a certain degree. Again, what type of impact is that going to have on the midterms? We don't know. But it does seem to be more of a mainstream thought process now, even for folks on the left that seem to indicate that this is a right decision and one that is more cheered than jeered on the left, certainly. Meanwhile, 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rock your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. In spite of economic challenges facing consumers these days, like inflation, gas prices, etc., Americans plan to travel this summer. in particular to live ticketed events ranging from sports to music festivals, with the youngest generations leading the way. New data from Allianz Partners Global Travel Confidence Index sheds light on this growing trend, showing that almost two-thirds of Gen Z, 65% to be exact, and millennials are planning to attend live entertainment or experiences as a reason to travel this summer, with more than half of Gen Z travelers indicating that at the heart of their travel inspiration and ambition is interest in attending ticketed events. And of course, that's great news for the travel, entertainment, and hospitality industries. With the 2026 FIFA World Cup kicking off across North America, sporting events are leading the way in terms of the most popular events and experiences, with 38% of travelers planning trips around sporting events or tournaments. However, Americans are also in search of immersive experiences like cruises, expeditions, hobby or sport-based travel, such as marathons and running events, and spa and wellness retreats are also getting a lot of attention. Emily Hartman, general manager at Allianz Partners, said in a statement, "Travelers today are looking for more than just time away. They're seeking experiences that feel meaningful, memorable, and worth investing in. Whether it's traveling for a once-in-a-lifetime concert, a championship sporting event, or a bucket list cruise, these trips often involve significant emotional and financial investment," added Hartman. Travel to ticketed events this summer. Gonna be hot. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the Great Voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
Well, he is known as the father of the Constitution. And not only did James Madison play a massive role in writing and shaping the U.S. Constitution during the Constitutional Convention of 1787, but he wrote much of the Bill of Rights. He was one of the co-authors with Alexander Hamilton and John Jay, who wrote the Federalist Papers, which was those series of essays that were explaining what the new U.S. Constitution was and defending the new U.S. Constitution and urging the colonies to take it up and defend it. And that, of course, are some of the highlights for James Madison, but a consequential figure in U.S. history. Jack Rakove is the co-professor of history and American studies and professor of political science emeritus at Stanford University, and joins us this morning to talk about who I think professor has a larger than life stature in American history, but he was not physically a large man.
He was relatively slight, soft-spoken in presence. People sometimes complained, like in the Virginia Ratification Convention, that they found it hard to hear him speak. But he became a great storyteller, and people have great stories about visiting his house in Montpelier outside Orange, Virginia, and being regaled with stories about the Revolution and so on.
Well, let's back it up a little bit with James Madison. James Madison wasn't the figure that maybe Thomas Jefferson was, or even George Washington was, obviously. What was his upbringing? How did he differ from maybe some of the others?
Well, he's pretty similar to Jefferson in some ways. I mean, he came from his father, James Madison Sr., was probably the largest landowner in Orange County, Virginia. Probably had more slaves than any of the other planters in the neighborhood. Madison was well-educated. He was sent off as a young man when he was about 14 or so to the College of New Jersey, which we now know better as Princeton University. He was the eldest of, the 9 or 10 other siblings. In a sense, the privileged son of a wealthy planter, extremely well-educated. And he was able to devote his life to politics. And as a young man, he was somewhat aimless when he finished his studies at Princeton and went back to Virginia. He wasn't really quite sure what he wanted to do with life. May have been a bit of a hypochondriac, worried a lot about his health. And then the Revolution basically gave him a career.
And what was his role? How did he view what the Revolution was going to be about?
Well, I think he shared the views of most of the group we called the Patriots. By 1774, 1775, although some people felt that Boston may have gone a bit far in terms of dumping the tea into the harbor in December 1773. I mean, he felt like most Patriots that the British government was badly misstepping in its attempts to govern America, that its claim
its claimed the parliament could legislate for the Americans and the American colonists in all cases whatsoever was outrageous. And you know, once the revolution broke, he wasn't quite sure what he was going to do, but he served in the fifth provincial convention that wrote the first Virginia state constitution, served in the Virginia legislature, lost re-election, served in the Virginia Council of State, and then in 1780 he went off to the Continental Congress meeting in Philadelphia, and he served there for 3.5 years without going home once. Mm. So he was really awakened politically by the revolution. The revolution gave him a career. And Madison made a career out of politics in a way that few of his contemporaries would have done in the same way.
I'm curious to know what his role was in writing and crafting the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, because I had read at some point that he was unsure if a Bill of Rights was even necessary.
Well, he remained unsure even while he wrote it, but I think it's better to step up and go back to your opening remark. We always called Madison the father of the Constitution, and you know that term is fine in and of itself, but it's also a bit vague and imprecise. So I think it's better to think of him as the grand strategist of constitutional reform, and that was true in the 1780s when the Articles of Confederation was collapsing. People at the time said the Continental Congress had become an imbecile form of government. I think Madison played a more active role than anyone else in the politics in 1786 and 1787 that led to the calling of the Constitutional Convention. He and the other Virginians got to Philadelphia early, and they discussed the idea of let's try to set an agenda for the convention. The basic agenda is what we call the Virginia Plan, and that was mostly the work of Madison's own studies back in Montpelier, and then when he's back in New York and when he's finally returned to the Continental Congress. And I think when the Constitution was finally ratified, although Madison did not think a Bill of Rights was necessary, he felt in some ways it was superfluous. He also saw that there might be some dangers in having one. He nevertheless decided that to bring the whole process of ratifying the Constitution to a happy close, there are a lot of well-meaning, if somewhat misguided, anti-Federalists, opponents of the Constitution out there, who really seemed to think adding a Bill of Rights was necessary. So Madison decided that he really had to push it through the first federal Congress, even though privately he called it the nauseous project of amendment.
We haven't really delved into Hamilton so much in our series looking at the Founding Fathers because of the popularity of the musical and how big that's gotten. Yeah. But I do want to focus a little bit on that meeting with Hamilton and Jefferson and Madison and how they ended up settling on Washington being the location for the Capitol.
Well, it's just part of the big debate over, getting Congress to issue a charter for a national bank. You know, so Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury. Hamilton was a brilliant statesman. Hamilton had really studied the issues of public finance quite carefully. And he was really committed to having a bank as an essential instrument for reforming the whole financial government. The Virginians were really committed to having a capital on the banks of the Potomac. I mean, Washington was probably the leading advocate of it, but they felt in different ways that actually having a serious city like that in Virginia would be very helpful to the state's future economic development. And so they reached a kind of an impasse. It's basically a bargain. It's basically a deal. Mm. And it advanced the story. You know, even after they passed it, they weren't wholly sure that the Capitol would finally go there. So Congress was in New York. It went New York City, the first federal Congress. And then it went back to Philadelphia. And then people felt that Philadelphia, of course, was America's largest city and a great town. They thought maybe it would just stay there, but they went ahead with the project along the Potomac.
I Madison also has a unique experience situated in history because he had two forays into the battles with the British, obviously with the Revolution and then the War of 1812, where British troops burned down the White House and burned down the Capitol as well. What was that time period like for him?
The War of 1812. Well, he's the only president ever to have been actively on a battlefield. Though it wasn't a great adventure. It's at the Battle of Bladensburg, which is a little Maryland town outside Washington. He retreats to Washington. They have to leave. I mean, it was a great embarrassment. I mean, the bigger argument that some scholars make is that we don't think of Madison as a great wartime president.
But the contrary argument is Madison wanted to make sure that the presidency remained an essentially Republican institution, Republican, you know, lowercase r, meaning he was not a great enthusiast for executive power in the same way that Alexander Hamilton was. And so if you want to give his presidency a more powerful evaluation, you'd say he was trying to govern, you know, consistent with those norms. You know, he let New England essentially go its own way.
Yeah.
You know, there's a group of very strong dissenters, you know, in the northeastern most states, and they basically sit the war out, and, you know, Madison wasn't happy about it, but on the other hand, he didn't want to turn it into another political cause that might itself, threaten the durability of the Union.
I have 30 seconds left here. Was Dolly really more famous?
More famous than Madison?
Yeah.
I don't think she's more famous, but she was an accomplished first lady. Many historians see her really as the first genuine first lady, because Abigail, Martha Washington filled that role, but in a very formal way. And, you know, the Washington court was, you know, wasn't the happiest place. Abigail Adams would rather stayed mostly in Massachusetts. Jefferson, of course, had been widowed, and Dolly, in some ways, stood in as a surrogate first lady. And so I think people see her as really the first active first lady. Maybe not quite in the Jackie Kennedy character, but by 19th century standards, still a pretty strong one.
Jack Rakove, professor at Stanford University, thank you for your time, the insight on James Madison. Really appreciate it. And we'll talk again very soon, I hope.
My pleasure.
Yeah. We'll take a break. More coming up next on JR Morning. Well, NASA's starting to make clear what their plans are for the moon. We've heard about this moon base that they want to put on the surface of the moon. And the agency announced yesterday, NASA, that it's awarded yet another round of contracts to private space companies to the tune of $600 million. That brings the amount of funding to nearly $1 billion. All in all, NASA plans to spend $20 billion on this project over the next 7 years. So what does this money go to? What are they planning? Eben Brown, our Fox News reporter and WJR contributor, joins me this morning to talk about it. Eben, it's good to have you back. What did NASA lay out yesterday?
Yeah, good morning. So this is all part of the Artemis program, of going back to the moon and setting up a permanent presence. And to do that, of course, we do need a moon base. And so NASA announced yesterday contracts worth about $600 million. For three different companies that will be able to deliver via landing craft equipment to the moon. And these three companies have been doing this kind of work for a while. One of them has actually already landed something on the moon successfully. The others have come close, but NASA is a big believer in their abilities, their technologies, their methods, and their efforts. So they've given them, you know, contracts. And what this is not to land humans per se, but it is to be able to land equipment and building materials, which we will need. So we will need to have the ability to get things to the moon, especially when we begin constructing the moon base, which can be done either with human astronauts doing the work or maybe even robots to a degree. This moves this process along pretty quickly. So we could even start seeing some of these missions land on the moon late 2028. So that's not that far off.
It's not that far off. It's going to be here in the blink of an eye. And so these are like lunar rovers that are going to be deployed there.
I wouldn't call rovers, landers.
Landers.
More than the rovers are things that could move around.
Right.
And there is talk about sending a rover to the moon. It's actually a rover that was initially designed using the same designs for the Mars rovers, but just wasn't sent. So that kind of shows that NASA has the ability to repurpose and reuse things that they've already either designed or maybe even built, as opposed to every time there's a new goal starting from scratch, which has always been kind of not exactly cost effective.
Interesting. Are they talking about, when it comes to the actual construction process, are they going to be building this base there? Are they going to be prefabbing some of this back on Earth? Have they talked about that process?
Probably a mix of both.
Yeah.
Certain things can be built on Earth and then sent, and then other things can just simply, the materials can be sent and then could be constructed or assembled at the destination. And that's kind of what NASA has been learning to do all these decades. If you think about every different program that NASA has had through the years, Yes, there was the goal of getting to the moon with Apollo and all of that, but everything else was a step in learning how to work in space. The Mercury Project, we sent one person to space. Okay, we learned we could do that. We learned what the human body does in that environment. Then we sent two people to in the Gemini capsules. And how did that work out? That was about two people working together in space. And then three people on Apollo who could then get to the moon and come back. That was, you know, a goal reached. Then it was the space shuttle, a reusable craft that could bring very large objects up to space and then eventually construct the space station, a major, major undertaking. So we've learned how to build things off the planet. Now we can take all of those skills, all of those best methods, and apply it to this. So we're not relearning how to build something. We're taking, or they are, I should say. I say we because we as Americans should own this. But we're taking our skills, our best practices, everything we've learned over, you know, since the 1960s, and we're going to go take it to build this structure on the moon.
Mm. Did they lay out any sort of involvement from Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk in their space companies in this process?
Well, they're already involved. SpaceX has contracts. Blue Origin, the Jeff Bezos company, has contracts to develop and use lunar landers and their rockets to transport, you know, our people to the moon. So they already are heavily involved in this.
Well, it's fascinating. And then you look at, again, you talk about the speed. It seemed like they were almost behind the eight ball to a certain degree, but they're pushing forward here. Are they talking about still being on time?
I think generally the idea is to stay as on time as they can and not get into the usual NASA funk of, you know, we're delayed by a decade, which has sort of been a problem that NASA's experienced over the years. And if you remember the original announcement of the Artemis program, the idea of going back to the moon and staying, you know, President Trump announced it rather early in his first term, and he kind of wanted it done by the time he got into what would have been a second term or what became President Biden's term, and it got delayed under the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. And so that I don't think sat well. I think President Trump and Jared Isaacman, the new NASA director, have been trying to push the timeline as best as they can. Of course, there's always safety concerns. You don't want to go in an unsafe method, but it also, you know, they have the flexibility of rethinking their ideas, their plans, you know, midway through to say, hey, are we best using time and money here? And so that's why we've seen a change in what NASA will do with the next Artemis mission. Artemis 3 was originally intended to go to the moon. They decided to move up Artemis 3, but also use it in low Earth orbit to practice and demonstrate the rendezvous techniques and the docking with the lunar landers. So that's you know, a better use of time, and that allows them to have those skills and that data for the next mission, Artemis 4. Which will, you know, if everything stays as it is, we'll put boots back on the lunar ground.
Very cool. Evan Brown, always appreciate the updates. Thank you. We'll talk soon.
You bet. Take care.
You got it. Meanwhile, the interesting thing about these companies that have gotten this money, none of them are designing from scratch. They have been in development for this for years. Obviously, they've had different contracts with NASA previously. And so at this point, it's all about the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. It's all about the equipment that they are working on to get up there. And it's just how to get it up there, how to go through the testing process by 2028 so that these machines, this equipment can land on the moon safely. Really fascinating stuff. Meanwhile, should childcare cost sharing programs here in the state of Michigan become permanent? Something being talked about in Lansing. We'll talk about it on the other side here on JR Morning. So 5 years ago, Michigan unveiled the TriShare Childcare Program. It is a way to support working families and make it more affordable for their kids to be in daycare. And it works that the employee will pay 33%, the employer will pay 33%, and the state of Michigan will pay a 33% share of what it costs for that child care bill. And the idea here is it makes it more affordable for families to get that child care that they need so that they can have a job here in the state of Michigan, work, and be a productive member of our economy. And there is efforts underway in Lansing because this has been hailed as a
pretty solid program. And in fact, other states are even looking at it as a model to help folks afford childcare. And there's an effort in Lansing to make this permanent. And Gary Van Workum is the representative out of the 88th District and joins me this morning to talk about it. Representative, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
First of all, let's talk a little bit about where this stands today. As I understand it, there is no sunset on this, but where do we stand and why are we trying to make it permanent now?
Yeah, there's no sunset, but what it does is it kind of lives in Lansing terms in boilerplate. So whenever we pass a budget, we have a section which outlines how this program works. And rather than having to do that process every time, I've introduced legislation to make the program permanent so that whenever you're having the budget discussion, the procedures are already outlined, how it works is outlined, make that statutory law, and that's just a conversation of how much need is out there and how much the program should get funded every year.
How has this program expanded over the years to where it should be more permanent?
The basis has kind of stayed the same throughout. I wrote this program back in, I believe, 2020. And the basis has kind of always been there. The issue has been about how many employers you can engage and bring along. The state has found several partners, which are known as the facilitator hubs, which are local folks that run the program so that they know the employers, they know the providers, they know the families, which I think is a key part to this. Mm-hmm. So it's expanded in that it now covers all 83 counties, whereas when it first started, it was a pilot project in three areas. So it has expanded, but the basis of it has held true throughout the process.
Representative Greg Van Workum joins me this morning to talk about the Michigan TriShare program. And what has been the benefit? When you hear from folks that need the child care, or you hear from employers, for example, what's been the information that you're getting back from them?
So I recently did a meeting with my local chamber here in Grand Haven, and it was on child care. And they started talking about this new TriShare program, not knowing that I was actually the one that put this together. And they were just glowing about how it's helped so many families and so many employers. Just the cost so people can stay working. When we first were working on this, we looked at it as a workforce development rather than education or healthcare or dealing with LARA. How do we get people to stay in the workforce? So many families have had that kitchen table conversation of whether it makes sense for both parents to continue to work or not. This has given them the ability to stay in the workforce, and it's been a great retention tool for employers throughout the state. I can see on the TriShare website, it saved families over $14 million. Mm. And it's kept some good quality people in the workforce.
How much does the state spend on this program yearly?
So right now the budget is about $3.4 million. Mm. So that's a massive return for a program this size of what we can do. Now, there's a lot of money that's spent in childcare, and that deals with the low-income subsidy. This was taking a different look at it, that we can come up with a way that's far more efficient to impact a lot of families and a lot of kids and a lot of employers. So it's a smaller investment in that childcare space that's done a lot for people and the state of Michigan.
Do you see a scenario in where that takes away some of the early childhood development money, where kids are able to, I think it's 4 years old, they get that free education? Do you see that going away with a program like this becoming expanded?
No, I don't see. I think those are kind of separate. Actually, okay. This is actually a response to some of the things that we've done in early education. A lot of child care providers their, so to speak, moneymakers were the five-year-olds, right? Where you didn't have to watch them all the time. They were a little bit more self-sufficient. You didn't have the ratios, and they were still paying the same amount for infants. When that went away, the providers were really hurting, and we were losing providers left and right. You were having these child care deserts, which still exist. So this was a way to try and help those providers as they were transitioning from losing those the five-year-olds. So it's a little separate, we wanted to make sure that we still had a strong child care provider network. And to do that, we needed to be a little bit more creative, because I don't think we want the schools now to be the child care providers as well. I think they have the American story as well, and they are the entrepreneurs, and they do a great job. So we want to make sure that we still have that ecosystem in place.
30 seconds left here. Where are we on the budget?
I'm going to get an update, but I'm the chair of the Medicaid and Behavioral Health budget, which is a big chunk of it. And we spent some wee hours this past weekend. So hopeful that we're putting the final touches on it, and we'll see something, and we'll see where it goes from there. I know I'm driving to Lansing in about 2.5 hours.
Good.
So I'll have more of an update when I get there.
Fire up the coffee. Keep it hot. We appreciate it. Greg Van Workum, thank you so much. We'll talk again very soon. More next on JR Morning. All right, 8 o'clock hour here on a Wednesday. Brian's without power. His house is a hot box. My air conditioner is on the fritz. And thankfully, the good folks at CNC Heating and Air Conditioning coming out to my house. Great friends of the station. And it's one of the things that you got to deal with in this heat is all of a sudden, perfect timing, your air goes out. Your power goes out, and now all of a sudden you're scrambling. Any restoration update on the Morton residents?
They say between 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. Here's the problem. Jason and I have been talking about this.
Oh, boy.
And I know this is
Brian's very
cynical.
Heated about it.
I'm very annoyed.
No pun intended.
It says
it's getting hot in here.
Crews are working diligently. And I told Jason,
well, of course they are.
I said, in my brain, they're going, I don't start till 9. I mean, it's only 150 people out of power. I'll get there eventually.
Yeah, but hold on. 150 people out of power when it's really hot.
Oh, I know. Look, I understand the truth of it, but how my brain works is like, we'll get there eventually.
Right now, Brian sees a crew of DTE members at Coney Island right now having breakfast.
Yeah. When I'm done with my coffee, we'll go right over and see what's going on. I know that, like I said, I don't want to diss anybody working for DTE, and especially if you're out working in this heat.
Yeah.
I don't diss anybody, but that's, my brain is going, oh, come on.
Of course.
Not a cloud in the sky. How is this possible?
We're going to talk about, coming up at 8:19, the impacts of the heat on work productivity, what it does to the GDP, what it does to the economy when it is oppressively hot, because there are some numbers, some correlations.
And it's very down here.
To it.
I could tell you that.
It's what?
It's down, down
in that
down
room.
In the room.
Yeah.
Well, like I told you earlier, we almost were unlucky because the air went out here in our studios overnight, and they fixed it. So we almost had to come into it, too.
Oh, my.
So it can't be done, Chris.
Now, we've done it before here, you know.
Sure.
But
yeah,
with you guys got going on at home, this would have just to really put the
I'd have been like, there's no,
cherry on
there's
top.
There's no escape.
Right?
I would have come in with ice packs under my armpits. Some sort of relief. By the way, the United States goes up against Bosnia-Herzegovina tonight, 8 o'clock on Fox. And how about this? It is poised to become the most bet-on World Cup game in American history. And there is no doubt that there is some buzz around this tournament, of course, centered here in North America, mostly here in the United States. The Americans, currently the consensus heavy favorites, minus 700 odds in this round of 32 matchup, minus 300 to win the game in regulation, the over-under 2.5 goals. I asked for a 3-0, 3-1, 3-0 lead win in that game. DraftKings director Johnny Avello telling The Athletic, the handle is off the charts at BetMGM. The handle of the 2022 finale between France and Argentina is the only World Cup game with a higher handle than the Americans' three group play games in the sportsbook history this year. We expect USA-Bosnia to be the single most bet World Cup game ever. Ever. That's the excitement here. I was reading another piece on this, and they said that this could beat March Madness. I mean, that is stunning.
That's crazy.
Stunning.
Crazy.
Now, it absolutely plays a role that it's here.
Oh,
it
yeah.
It is unavoidable here. Even when we're not seeing the games here, we don't have that influx of fans here in the city of Detroit, but we're seeing it everywhere. It is unavoidable. And so there is excitement just that it's here in the United States, all the fans, the whole thing, yada, yada. We've talked about it. But people are getting in on the action, even if they don't necessarily know the game.
That would be
if
the
you're,
issue.
If you're a fly-by-night soccer fan, you're throwing a little action down on this because of the excitement.
Yeah. And I, like you said, if you're a fly-by-night fan, like if I wanted to bet on baseball, you know how much I know about baseball.
Yes.
I would ask Jason.
What shape is the ball, Brian?
What do you think? Yeah. What do you think about this? Who am I going to talk to bet on this? Or am I just going like, USA,
right.
USA.
I think that's it. I think that's where people are at.
I'm sure that's where they're at, but I'm not sure that's the best way to bet if you're going to try to win.
Hey, man, your money, you do what you want with it. God bless. I have no help for you there.
Probably lasts longer than in one of those Sweet 16 brackets, right?
Yes. Brian calls it the Sweet 16 bracket.
I don't know what the hell it is.
I love it.
That's just when he starts paying attention.
Yeah, at the Sweet 16, exactly. Meanwhile,
Brian waits all year for the Sweet 16. Forget the round of 32. Forget all that playing stuff.
He just holds his breath with bated excitement on the Sweet 16. Meanwhile, the U.S. Supreme Court handed Donald Trump, I guess it's a procedural victory, but they ruled 6-3 on birthright citizenship, that it basically stays as is, that the executive order is nullified, that according to the 14th Amendment, how it's written, the domicile question was big in oral arguments, the precedent that was set in the case in the late 1800s with the Chinese family was precedent. And so they ruled in 6-3 fashion that judges don't have the authority to issue these sweeping nationwide injunctions to block a policy across the entire country. This belongs to lawmakers, and that's how they rule on this. And Chief Justice John Roberts joined the three liberal justices and Amy Coney Barrett that said anyone born in the U.S. on U.S. soil is a citizen regardless of whether their parents are in the country illegally or temporarily. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote the dissent, and he said in that dissent that citizenship requires a deeper connection to the United States than simply being born here. And he contends that the 14th Amendment was intended primarily to secure citizenship for formerly enslaved people post-Civil War and not for the children of temporary visitors of this country, and that would make it unlawful. So interesting how that broke down in some of the dissents and the majority viewpoint on that issue. Also, the transgender athlete issue, 6-3 vote. States may restrict girls and women's sports teams to athletes based on biological sex. That stemmed from cases out of West Virginia and Idaho that were challenged by transgender athletes. And much of this focused on whether transgender girls and women have a right under Title IX in the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause to compete on teams matching their gender identity. And what all nine justices agreed is that this was not a violation of Title IX, which was a major focus in that case and in those oral arguments. Meanwhile, we have no state budget yet. The self-imposed deadline of July 1st is here. They do have an opportunity to get something done today. And we're going to talk to Mike Harris, the representative, coming up at 8:35 on that issue, because there are a number of things up in the air. And again, going back to last year, I think they were a week late. They extended it a week. And the fiscal year doesn't start till October, so they do have a bit of a runway. But the idea of setting this in July 1st, one of the main reasons, was that it gives schools in the state of Michigan an opportunity to plan and have their budget set and know what they've got to spend. And as we sit here today, we don't quite have that yet. Also, Tigers big winners yesterday over the Yankees, 9-3. Five home runs. Riley Green went yard twice, 3 RBI for him. Kerry Carpenter, Spencer Torkelson, and James Outman also going deep in the bandbox that is Yankee Stadium. Tarek Skubal on the bump. He said he felt good.
You know, I think the last time was pretty good too. This time was obviously, I think the results were a little bit better, but I think, I think it's right on par with kind of how I've been feeling. You know, even the second one, you know, against the White Sox, I thought was a good one. The first one against Cleveland definitely felt a little bit, I was kind of a little bit maybe more amped up or something because I was spraying the ball a little bit, just excited to be back out there. And I think that's just the human element of the game. But, you know, I felt great. You know, I don't think the results have kind of been a testament of who I am and the stuff coming out of my hand.
So Tigers win. They win that series. They've got the third game of that set coming up today.
This afternoon.
Yes, this afternoon. What time? 1:10?
1:35.
1:35 first pitch. Thank you, Jason.
Sweep them.
That's right. Bring out the brooms. Coming up on the other side, how does the heat impact your work productivity? It's next on JR Morning. All right, so you heard the forecast there. We could touch 99 degrees today. That would be a record. It's going to feel like a balmy 106 degrees here in the great city of Detroit.
It's getting hot in here.
It's already hot in here. That's the point. And the question is, how does that impact your work productivity? Because there's an interesting piece put out by Katharina Joino of Fortune. And there has been obviously heat all across the United States. We've talked about that, this heat wave. It's also hitting Europe as well. And so with this heat, I mean, you're talking about even deaths in some parts of the world that are expected because of this heat. How is the productivity? What is the GDP loss of this heat? Let's talk about it. Katharina Joino joins us to talk about it. It's good to have you.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
So let's talk a little bit about, first of all, what do you expect as an employee when this heat wave hits? Here in the United States, we go from, hopefully, in most of our cases, one air-conditioned place to your air-conditioned car to your air-conditioned office, and that makes productivity seamless. But for other places in the world, that might not be the case.
Sure, and also don't forget the fact that that's for you and me who maybe might have access to air conditioning. Those who are, let's say, chefs and they're working in ambient sure. heat environments, those who are construction workers working outside, that's still affecting the GDP no matter what. And we're also getting hit with a lot of lack of air conditioning. That movement from us in our cars or on the train towards our office, we're still getting hit by the same effects as people who don't have AC in the first place.
So as the heat gets higher, as it gets hotter, is there direct correlations to a loss in productivity?
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, the chemical research in general says that for every Celsius degree above the average, it reduces the average GDP per capita growth between 0.7% and 1.3%. And that's not even crazier. It affects people when it's mildly balmy, let's say, not even these 100 triple-digit degree days. The Lawrence Berkeley lab saw that productivity peaks around 72% or 72 degrees Fahrenheit. And it falls around 2% per degree for every degree above 77 degrees. So we've already been acting pretty delirious since, April. And now we're just getting hit by it.
Is there any sort of effort underway legislatively to curtail, businesses at this point? I mean, it doesn't seem like that's something companies would be interested in. But at the same time, if their payroll is not going to meet the productivity, well, that becomes problematic.
Absolutely. And I spoke to Wharton professor R. Jisman Park, and he's the author of Slow Burn. He studied this. He studied the effects of labor and climate change. So this is right in his wheelhouse, but that's his main theory and his main point. You can have a company that says, hey, we have XYZ percent of revenue, but if they're not studying the effects of their actual ambient environment on the employees, they're losing out on billions of dollars a year and lost productivity and revenue.
Who's hit harder? Is it us here in the United States or is it Europe?
It's kind of both, honestly. I mean, Europe is definitely because of the lack of infrastructure and AC. So the U.S. Energy Administration released that between 80 to 90% of American households have air conditioning. If you're a white-collar worker, you're going into an office that likely has air conditioning. Compare that to Europe. I mean, if you look at Germany, around 90% of the country has AC, and that's double what it was just 2 years ago. The UK, only 5% to 7% of homes have AC.
Huh, really interesting stuff. Fascinating as we all try to deal with the heat in different ways. Katharina DeGioino, thank you so much for your time this morning. Interesting piece. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
Yeah, thank you. Lovely to see you.
Yeah, you got it. Meanwhile, this is, again, World Cup action taking over the United States. The USA plays tonight against Bosnia-Herzegovina, 8 o'clock on Fox. But let me give you a couple of stories here. So Saturday, Croatia takes on Ghana in Philadelphia. So all the Croatian fans are in Philly. And what we have seen is that these visiting fans take over these cities. And now, amongst all of the 250th birthday celebration that's happening in places like Philadelphia, you've got an influx of soccer fans from Croatia. Well, how about this? There was a group of Croatian fans outside of Philadelphia City Hall. And outside Philadelphia City Hall, amongst the Croatian fans, was a wedding party that were taking pictures. This group of Croatian fans surrounded the wedding party, dancing, cheering. They were taking pictures with the wedding party. The wedding party's official photographer was there taking pictures. The whole bridal party was dancing along. The groom at one point I saw was down on the ground in his suit partying with these people. Now, that could have gone one of two ways. It could have gone the way it did, thankfully. Everybody was having a good time with it. What are you going to do? You can't avoid it. Or it could have gone down like, these people want to be left alone. They it's their wedding day. They want to take their pictures with their bridal party and their parents and do the whole deal so that they have these nice, and I'm sure they did, but you didn't want to be mobbed by a bunch of Croatian soccer fans. That was not on their bingo card. And thankfully, they played along and went along with it. How awesome is that? And the scenes are unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. But it didn't get ugly. Everybody was cool, rolled with the punches, and made for a great moment. And again, you're going to look back at those pictures. You're going to go, oh, here we are all standing in front of City Hall taking a nice picture. But right before this, we were surrounded by Croatian soccer fans. And it was madness. And then you show those pictures. I think it's fantastic. Great story.
And you're right. It could go either way.
It could have got really bad.
You have a bridezilla. You know, she melts down because there's Croatians invading everything. But here's the thing about these soccer fans coming here is they're all so joyful.
Sure.
And they're so happy. It is infectious.
Yeah, they're in America. It's awesome.
And they're here to have fun. They're not here to cause trouble. They're not here for anything. And everything is great. I mean, I've saw people that's like, it's Chick-fil-A. This is the greatest ever. It's like, it's Chick-fil-A.
Yes.
Calm down.
Yeah. No? And then the Argentinian fans, they get to Dallas. Somebody loses their wallet. They look at the name and they all start chanting this guy's name. So they could find the owner of the wallet.
That is awesome.
There's a group of angry Argentinians looking for you, Bob.
No.
Like, oh,
no.
How much money is in that wallet? Yeah, that's me.
And by the way, they found the guy.
Of course they did.
It's awesome.
It's very cool.
It is absolutely fantastic. Coming up on the other side, what's the deal with the state budget? It's coming up. Here is your chance to win a trip to see two country superstars, Jason Aldean and Luke Bryan, in Vegas. Double the hits, one unforgettable night. We've got your flights, hotel, and concert tickets covered. The Double Down Tour, Aldean and Bryan co-headlining with special guest John Party and Chase Matthews, all live under the neon lights. Prize provided by BBR Music Group. Texas Hours national keyword, RAIN, to 95819. That's RAIN to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. Official rules and more info is at WJR.com. Meanwhile, the lawmakers here in our state, in Lansing, are working hard to finalize a budget under the self-imposed deadline of today. And sounds like everybody is converging on Lansing this afternoon to try to work out the details. Let's get the latest. Representative Mike Harris rejoins us this morning. It's good to have you back.
Chris, always good to be here.
So did you get enough sleep last night? Were you guys hard at work? Where are we at in this process?
Yeah, this is always a battle this time of year, every year. But listen, I know this is on everybody's mind. We do have very positive discussions that are continuing, and I am very confident that we're going to have a deal here very soon. And the important thing is, I think Michigan's going to get a good deal out of this because we've already locked in several priorities and gotten that framework signed by the Senate and the governor. So, for example, we got a smaller budget coming than we had last year. And I think House Republicans proved last time that the government was filled with wasteful spending. And mm-hmm. I think you and I had talked about that last time.
Yep.
But we're committed to doing the same thing this year. And I think we found more spending that we can rein in thanks to Speaker Hall and our appropriator Anbel. And we've really, really targeted wasteful spending. Another good thing for Michiganders is that we have no new tax hikes coming. So the governor and the Senate Democrats were trying to push a new tax and fee increases in Michigan, and we said no. That was a dead-on-arrival deal for House Republicans, and everybody signed on, again, to a framework that agrees to no new tax increases. Mm. So I'm sure that's something that weighs on everybody's mind every year as we go through the budget.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about that. And then when it comes to the education spending, you know, getting this done ahead of that, the new budget year in October, important to for these school districts to understand how much money they're spending. Where are we at on that?
It really is. So we want to get this budget done for our schools and our local governments, especially. And like you said, we know how important it is for them to have the information they need to make the decisions that they have to make. And so our house plan includes historic highs for student spending, true universal breakfast and lunch for all kids. We propose massive increases in the classroom and school safety funding. And the great thing is, Chris, I think all sides came to the table with proposals that push for an increase in school funding. Mm. So I think the schools have some very positive things to look forward to. It's just negotiating those final deals so we can get this across the finish line.
So you do think today is the day you'll get it done?
I think this week is in. If I was a betting man, it's this week. I hope it's done today, but the proof's in the pudding, right? It
sure.
All depends on what's going on in those negotiation rooms. And our ropes team, I know, has been working nonstop, even through the weekend, trying to get this thing settled and figured out. So I think we're really, really close.
Very good. We'll continue to watch it. Keep us up to date on it. Mike Harris, the representative out of Michigan's 52nd. We appreciate your time as always. Thank you.
Anytime. Take care, Chris.
Yeah, you do the same. Meanwhile, in the latest case of, huh? Huh? What? What was that? Did I hear that, Craig? Representative, Congresswoman Diana DeGette lost her primary bid. She's the incumbent to a PhD student, Malat Kiros. This is now the third time that a Democratic socialist wins in a competitive House primary this cycle. And Kiros is a PhD student at the University of Denver. DeGette has been serving in Congress since 1997. And so it tells you that Democrats are upset with the status quo, at least in some cases. This isn't widespread yet, but it's almost like what we've seen with the Republican Party, is that there really was a change. Now, of course, you still have your staunch dyed-in-the-wool conservatives. You have your moderate Republicans, certainly. But there was a change under Donald Trump in the way that the Republican Party operated and the views that they hold. And so now you've got a third member of the Democratic Socialists of America that wins in a primary and is likely to win in an election up against a Republican in November. But this is really unbelievable. I want you to listen to a little bit of Milad Kyros in her victory speech in this primary. Listen very closely, because this is, I don't think we've heard this before.
From coast to coast, from every level of office, we are taking back our party and our country.
Can I have that one more time? What in the, huh? What? That is unbelievable. Unbelievable. That we're playing laser sound effects at a rally, at an acceptance speech. Now, we've seen the political landscape change. There's no doubt about that. Things have changed. Right? You've got politicians saying wild stuff now. But that was the first time I think I've ever heard a DJ play a laser sound effect at a primary acceptance speech. That is wild stuff. I don't know. If that's what the socialists are doing, I might be on board. That is crazy. Absolutely crazy. Now, again, she's a PhD student. She's still in college, so maybe that plays in. Younger votes, things like that. But wow. Absolutely unbelievable. And again, we talked a little bit about this yesterday, but the shift in the Democratic Party, at least in some of these congressional districts, is pretty unbelievable. It's a fascinating case study of what we're seeing on the left now, because what many on the left have been saying is that you've gone too far and all of a sudden I'm like a moderate. I'm like an independent all of a sudden in the way that I think that the party has gone too far left. And this is a continuation of that to some degree. But it's wild to think that we've got people out here playing laser sound effects. It's absolutely crazy. Wow. Unbelievable. Coming up next, Name That Tune. We've got tickets to Luke Bryan at Pine Knob Music Theater. We want you to play along. 800-859-0957. 800-859-0WJR. It's coming up next here on a Wednesday on JR Morning.